Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest this week is Rock and Roll Hall of Fame drummer and entrepreneur Matt Sorum. But first of all, you might have wondered how many people actually stream music in the United States. I know I have. Well, MusicWatch says there are 209 million streamers in the U.S. What's amazing about this is it's 86% of the population age 13 and older, and it's about 110 million more than there were 10 years ago. Now, if we look at the streaming platforms that people tend to use, worldwide now, 32% use Spotify, Apple is 16%, Amazon Music, 13%, Tencent, which is Chinese, 13%, YouTube Music by Google, 8%, NetEase, again, another Chinese streaming platform, 4%, Deezer, 2%, Yandex, yet another Asian streaming platform, 1%, Pandora, only 1%, and all the others, and there's 27 or 28, put them all together, they're 9%. Now, what's interesting here is some of these are growing faster than others. Might surprise you that the fastest growing one is YouTube Music, Tencent is second, and Amazon Music is third, and Apple Music is lagging behind. Now, it's still growing, but not nearly as much as it used to. What I find particularly interesting here is the fact that 86% of the population of the United States is streaming already. Now, that might get up into the 90s, but it also means there's not a whole lot of growth available. Now, the second thing that I find interesting is the fact that for the longest time, we always thought that once you subscribe to a music streaming platform like Spotify, you're pretty much not going to change because it's a pain to change. But we're seeing more and more people decide, oh, maybe I like YouTube Music better, maybe I like Apple Music better. There's a lot of people that actually have 2 and 3 streaming memberships, which is kind of weird because everybody has the same product. It's not like you're getting something different like on the video streaming platforms where there are exclusives on each one, and that makes you want to have a membership for each one. So we're in an ever-changing world when it comes to streaming. That being said, we are starting to top out on growth. So watch how that works with the music business, because right now everybody's riding high. That might not last much longer. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. Don't forget about my online courses on mixing, production, branding, and music business success at bobbyosinskicourses.com. Also, get an expert analysis and objective opinion of your songs and mixes as a member of my Hitmakers Club. Go to hitmakersclub.com to learn more. Now, if you really like synthesizers, especially vintage ones, or you've just been around for a long time, then you know the name Oberheim means a great-sounding analog synthesizer. And Oberheim was one of the giants in the 70s and 80s. Unfortunately, the company went into bankruptcy in 1985, and eventually Gibson bought the trademark and licensed the name to several companies, including the Italian organ maker Viscount. Now, a couple things happened from there. When Gibson was taken over by new management in 2019, they turned around and returned the U.S. trademark to Tom Oberheim, the founder and the namesake of the company. They did that just as a gesture of goodwill, which, good for them. Now, this goes another step, because that was just in the U.S. Behringer actually assumed the trademark in the rest of the world, and the reason why they could assume it is because it wasn't used for 20 years. So, because of lack of use, Behringer now gets the trademark. And the company is about to come out with some vintage Oberheim synthesizer knockoffs. So what they tried to do first is apply for a patent under the name Behringer Oberheim, but the patent was rejected. So I guess Behringer figured, well, we're not going to get any more mileage out of this name. So they returned it to Tom Oberheim as well. Now, this is the first time in 36 years that he's able to have that name trademarked in all of the world. So here's a couple of things that are going to happen now. We're going to see some new synthesizers coming out from the new Oberheim, but we're also going to see some Oberheim knockoffs come from Behringer as well. Behringer is really good at doing this. They reverse engineer a lot of gear, name it something different, make it look somewhat similar, and you know that's their business model. But that being said, you might want to hold out and get the real deal. My guest this week is Rock and Roll Hall of Fame drummer Matt Sorum, who held the drum chair for Guns N' Roses for 7 years, as well as stints with The Cult and Velvet Revolver. Matt's reputation as a musician's musician has placed him squarely at the center of Hollywood's A-list community of artists, working on projects with legends like Alice Cooper, Steven Tyler and Joe Perry of Aerosmith, Billy F. Gibbons from ZZ Top, Joe Elliott from Def Leppard, Robin Zander from Cheap Trick, and Brian May from Queen. Quite the entrepreneur, as a founder of 6 startup companies, Matt sits on the Global Blockchain Business Council at UCLA and has spoken at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. He's even created his own beer line, appropriately named The Drummer. Matt's autobiography, Double Talk and Jive, True Rock and Roll Stories from the Drummer of Guns N' Roses, The Cult, and Velvet Revolver, is available soon wherever books are sold. During the interview, we spoke about Matt's contribution to the Buddy Rich tribute album, getting his first big break, Lemmy and Motorhead stories, his entrepreneurship and charitable causes, his new biography, and much more. I spoke with Matt via Zoom. Let's start back at the beginning, though. I want to know how you got into the music business originally. How did it all happen?
Well, I luckily grew up in the 60s. You know, I was born in Long Beach, California, and I had 2 older brothers that were really music guys, you know, and I remember like I was so young, I was too young to miss the first time the Beatles came on Ed Sullivan, but I was old enough to remember at about 5 years old when they came on. I think it was the 3rd time they appeared on Ed Sullivan, and that was a big deal for families in those days. You know, on a Sunday night, you would sit in front of the variety show. So there we were, plopped on the couch, watching the RCA television, you know, the big box, right? And popcorn, stuff like that. And Ringo just caught my eye, man. And I was a little kid, you know, I was 5 years old. And that was it. I pointed at the TV and I said to my mom, he was like a cartoon character, you know, they all were. And that was pretty much it. That was the pinnacle moment. And, you know, years later, I got to meet him and I told him that. And he says, I said, you're the reason I'm a drummer. And he said, I hear that all the time. So I'm sure it happened for a lot of guys, you know, or girls or whoever wanted to be a musician. I mean, those guys were bigger than life. And so that was pretty much it. And then obviously throughout the 60s, I got my first record. It was a 45. My brother had one of those little Crossley turntables, you know, there was like a, you know, a little box. And I played the Hard Day's Night 45 over and over again. And then I got, you know, started banging on boxes and pots and pans. And my mom finally bought me a little drum set. On my 6th birthday, I got this little like Sears drum set. That was it. My brothers hated it, so they like trashed it. And then I got a St. George Silver Sparkle or a Blue Sparkle around my 9th birthday. And at that point, my brother started turning me on to records. So now we're into the late 60s. My brother was like listening to Hendrix and, you know, the Cream. And it was always blazing out of his bedroom, and I'd go in there and it was awesome. It was just a great time to grow up for music. It was amazing. And when the 70s hit, that was pretty much it for me. I was like already in a band in junior high school. I had a band in high school and it was all about Keith Moon. I wore a white jumpsuit. I was like, I wasn't really into Zeppelin. And I said this a lot, me and Paul Ill, we always chuck and jive on progressive music because all my friends were Zeppelin. And in those days, I don't want to say it was like Britney Spears, but it was mainstream. Zeppelin was like a mainstream band, if that makes any sense. And then So me and my weirdo buddies got into progressive music. You know, we were like into Genesis and Gentle Giant and Egg and Gong and all these weird bands. We just thought we were so cool. And we'd go to the import section of the record store. Remember that?
Yeah, yeah.
The English imports, and they'd be wrapped in plastic. And we were just into experimenting. So that's really was my sort of upbringing, you know, and I just loved it.
When did you get into it professionally, when you started to get paid?
Well, I was in a band, like I said, in high school called Prophecy. And the oldest guy in the band was this great guitarist, African-American dude. He was, I don't want to say he was like Hendrix, but he played a Strat. And we started sneaking up to Hollywood. And I was like 14, 15 years old. So I'm talking 1974, 75. And we used to play this club called the Starwood on Santa Monica Boulevard. And there was a Sunday night amateur night there. But you get $100. So officially I was professional, even though it covered, you know, us getting some food and gas and a couple guys to help out or whatever. But we got paid $100 to play at the Starwood. And I was like, does that mean I'm a professional musician? And I'm like, I guess so. And then I loved it. I just loved the excitement of Hollywood. I remember walking through that parking lot and feeling this intense energy rush over me. All these crazy looking characters. And in those days, Rodney Bingenheimer had moved his disco, the English disco, which used to be up on Sunset, he moved it down to the Starwood. So in one room was Rodney's English disco. And in the other room was the big rock room where I saw bands like Judas Priest. And I remember seeing Devo arrive on the scene, which was, if you remember, I think the late 70s, even the early 80s. And, bands that were just like mind blowing. And that was it for me. As soon as I graduated high school, I headed straight to Hollywood and never turned back.
I'm curious because you seem to have a rock background and you haven't mentioned anything about teachers or schooling or anything for music, but I know that you did Burning for Buddy. You really have to have some jazz chops to do that.
Well, I'll tell you what happened. In high school, I was in jazz band.
Ah, okay.
So in those days, you would get 3 electives. So you could do like your 4, like math, science, all that stuff. And you were allowed to pick, like, you know, it could be home economics or art or wood shop. And I picked wind ensemble, jazz band, and marching band. So I had 3 music classes a day. And I had a great teacher named Terry Newman, who was this jazz saxophone player. Decided to be a teacher because he got married, but the guy had skills. And I played in the jazz band. He always picked me. He loved me when I was playing like the Maynard Ferguson charts. Like there was a track, there was a version that Maynard did called Chameleon. Dun, 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 dun. Dun, 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 dun. It was like this funky, not Tower Power, but the other one.
Yeah.
That sounded like Tower Power, but it was similar. It was called, and then we do like Maynard version of Saturday in the Park. I don't know if you remember Maynard doing that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I always gravitated towards those, but it was a horn band and we were actually really good. And it was like it had a swing and a funk thing. And I could never get around playing that light to be a jazzer. I love smacking them because I went to see Black Sabbath when I was like 14. And it was like life-changing. I saw them, it was so heavy. And then Bill Ward was swinging like a jazz drummer.
Yeah.
But he was just smashing them. And I just loved it. And I loved the way it felt. So I just became a heavy hitter. But to go the other way was more difficult for me to play subtle and with a lot of like that whole style of drumming. That's a whole thing, ilk on its own. I say to those guys, wow. And then they'll look at me and go, how do you hit like that? You know, it's a whole different animal. So when the Burning for Buddy thing came along, I got this call from Kathy Rich, Buddy's daughter. And she says, Matt, Neil Peart's producing these records. And right away, I'm like, Neil Peart. And I'm like, really? She said, would you come play? He really wants you. And I do too. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm so honored. And at the same time, I was petrified. But I said, yes. And I remember walking into the power station in New York, and it was like, you know, Omar Hakim and Steve Gadd and, you know.
Yeah, the cats. Yeah, right.
Like, oh my God, really? And Dave Weckl going, hey man, you've been woodshedding on your chart. And so I picked this track, Bulowicz, which was early Buddy 60s. He got more into like a funk. He was starting to experiment more like Miles, you know, not, he didn't go as deep as Miles Davis. Miles got into like heavy metal, but he started experimenting with funk grooves. So I go, I can bite this off. This is good. This is something I think I could tackle. So I grabbed Bulowicz, and I remember going to the session, and that take that you see is actually the first take.
Wow.
And I felt something come over me. There was this poster of Buddy on the wall, and I just looked at him. I said, I know I'll never be as good as you. That's just never possible, maybe for any drummer on planet Earth. But just give me some guidance. It was almost like a God-like thing. It's like Buddy is God. You know, it's
yeah,
like...
Yeah.
Jump into my body and show me the way. And I went, man, I started playing with that horn band, and those horns were set up in front of me live. We were live in that session, and it was powerful, man. That was the heaviest shit I've ever heard. And I played with Motorhead. So that, yeah, yeah. You know, it was just like, it was so badass. And I was honored to be there, and I'm honored I got to do it. Came out great, and people always say that to me. Wow, man, I didn't know, you know.
Yeah, it's a big change, and people don't perceive you as that. But you know what's funny? You mentioned about Bill Ward and how he swings, but all those English drummers, they all had a jazz background. They could all swing. And yeah. you pick out any of those early English bands, and you go, what's different? Well, the drummers, they had that swing thing going from jazz background. It was awesome.
Yeah, well, yeah. Especially John Bonham, you look at him, I think he loved Motown, you know, he loved Little Richard, you know.
Yeah.
He listened to that stuff and incorporated it into the band, and it was like, oh my God, you know. And, you know, my situation was, you know, I got in these real, like The Cult was my first big band, and that was almost like AC/DC. It was real meat and potato drumming. And, you know, it still could swing. You know, The Cult have like a good below the waist kind of feel to it. And when Guns N' Roses came along, it was the early 90s when I made those records. Rhythmically, something had shifted from sort of like the hair metal era. I think everyone was trying to emulate Kashmir, but they got it completely wrong.
Yeah.
Like, you know, down on swings.
Yeah.
But also came boosh, ush, boosh, ush. You know,
yeah.
Became this thing. And the band had this like punk sensibility too, which was sort of aggressive and maybe a little bit on top of the beat, but it gave it the right amount of angst. And I understood it. Getting back to those records, it had a lot of echo on the snare drum, shit like that, you know.
Yeah.
Reverb was very important on a snare in those days.
Yeah.
If they dried up those records, if they went back and remixed them up, it could probably, it would have a better feel, because the reverb wouldn't take up so much space, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. How did you get the Cult gig?
Well, I was kind of a man about town. You know, I was playing in like, at one time I had 10 bands going. I was like Matt the Mercenary was my nickname. And you could get me for a rehearsal for $25. And I would do your gig between 50 and 75. That was my rate. And I was really fast. I was a fast learner. And, I, you know, I could read and everything, but I could listen and pick it up. Like, even Paul, this happened, you know, I've gone on gigs and be like, hey, you know, we got to learn these 10 songs and we're going to play those, you know, tomorrow. You know, and for a drummer, it's not as difficult because you don't have to hit notes, but I just had that knack. I could go and do a lot of play a lot of gigs. So guys started hearing about me, and there was this really cool drummer, and we were sort of in line, this drummer named Pat Torpey. And he was playing with Jimmy Page and Robert Plant when they went out and did that tour, just the two of them. And the Colts saw him first, Pat and the band. And Pat goes, I can't do it. I'm starting a band called Mr. Big, but I know this guy. And it was always me replacing him or him replacing me, you know? And I replaced him on another record called Jeff Paris. We were on Polygram Records. And I came in and filled in for him. So he hooked me up. And then a couple of other people told them about me. And then I went to this rehearsal space. Of course, I woodshedded. And I tell every drummer that goes, or any musician that goes for an audition, learn all their shit. Right?
Yeah.
And there was early versions of the Cult that had Mark Brzezicki on drums, more real spicy. And then they got in kind of this heavy era, loose drummer named Les Warner. But I tried to kind of cop their styles and went into my thing. And I remember the part, I was in all black. I looked at them, I studied them, and I went in there and I got the gig. You know, it was my first real jump start into arena rock. And it was great.
How did that lead to Guns N' Roses then?
Well, Guns N' Roses originally opened for the Cult before I was in the Cult. And so we're huge fans of the Cult. And I remember playing at the old Universal Amphitheater, and Duff and Slash showed up at the gig and saw me play. And they needed to replace their original drummer, Steven Adler. And I was the guy that got the call. They called me up. The tour had ended. I was real sick. I had walking pneumonia on tour for like 6 months. And I came home and I fell out. I was at my mom's house. And I got a call from Mike Klink, the producer, saying, hey, someone's calling you. My mom comes in the room and says, there's somebody named Slick on the phone. I was like, what? I pick up the phone, and of course, it's like, hey, it's Slash. Mom, it's Slash, not Slush. And anyway, Slash says, hey, man, we saw you play last night or a couple nights before, whatever it was. And we really dug it, man. Can you come up and play with us? So I went up to L.A. and I moved into the Oakwood Apartments off Barham Drive. You know that is?
Oh, yeah.
The rock and roll, like, apartment building. You know, like divorcees or, you know, band guys or wayward people. And went down and started playing with the guys on the intention that I was just going to record the records. And we just hit it off. I could drink with them. I was a good drinker. That was important. And, you know, I got my wings with the Cult. I mean, that was a British band. We drank pints of lager, right? It was important to have camaraderie in a band in those days. We weren't punching a time clock. We were a gang of, you know, pirates. We were on a ship to, you know, pillage, and that's what we did. And so I fit right in. They were like, we want you in the band, join the band. At that point, I started learning how to negotiate for myself. I got myself a membership position, you know, percentage. I wasn't a sideman. It was great. I was in the band. I was in the band photo. You know, I was accepted in that group. Same with the Cult, though, too.
I know you did a tour with Motorhead. How did that happen?
Yeah. Well, throughout the years, I'd always run across Lemmy. You know, and I loved the guy. He was just...
At the Rainbow, right?
Well, yeah, but I actually met him in England because I lived in London with the Cult. So the first time I met him, I was with this drummer named Randy Castillo, who was a really good buddy of mine who ended up passing away, and great drummer, cool dude, rock and roll shenanigan guy with me. And we met him at this club in London. And after that, when he moved to Hollywood, right away, he was a fixture at the Rainbow.
Yeah,
right. And he'd call, and he never had a car, never drove. and say, hey, let me, you need a ride anywhere? He called me one time and had to give him a ride somewhere. We just became friends. And then he started playing with this group I had called Camp Freddy with Dave Navarro. I'd call him up. Let me come sing God Saves the Queen by the Pistols. He goes, oh, okay, that sounds good. Let's do some Eddie Cochran too. He loved Eddie Cochran. He loved rockabilly. And he loved ABBA.
Who would have thought? Wow.
Don't tell anybody. I go, that's fucking great songs. I mean, come on. Yeah. They're the richest people from Sweden. What's not to like?
Yeah.
And so, but you know, I got this call one day. Our drummer is going to do some stupid Swedish TV show. And I need you. And I texted him back. I said, when? He said, meet us in Washington, D.C. So I got this DVD of a Wacken festival. He said, learn the set and meet us there. We'll get a sound check in and start the tour. And I was like, holy shit, wow. Really? And the music was actually simple but difficult at the same time because it had similar beats. It was like a boogabaka, boogabaka, a lot of that.
Yeah.
Different tempos. And I couldn't decipher some of them. It was like, holy shit, is this? So I had to kind of put on my thinking cap with that. It was like, it was all about tempo. How hard did I have to put on the aggression? It was like a lot of intensity. It had to be intense. It had to be powerful and it had to be tempo. It had to be correct. Didn't like things too fast. He liked them right. And like even on Ace of Spades, if I play that too fast, he'd turn around and look at me and go, too fast. And I pull it back. It was like, it was a medium between laying back and pushing forward, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, yeah. So you're playing on top of the beat, mostly.
On top of the beat, but like restrained.
Yeah, yeah.
Weird, like, you know, like aggressive, but just in it. So it was fun. It was like, I said, I can retire now. This was like the pinnacle. It really was. It was a career highlight for me because that was a band that was a mainstay. It was like the Ramones, you know? It was like, they're not going anywhere. They're not changing for anybody. You know, they're not going to change their outfit. They're not going to try to like create a song just because the times have changed. Everything was just, this is what we do. And that's, in my opinion, that's probably the most punk rock statement anyone can make. They just don't assimilate what they do with what everybody else is doing. They're just Motorhead.
Changing the subject for a little bit. I know you have quite the entrepreneur streak in you. And I know you've done a lot of different things that are related to music, but not quite music. How did that happen?
Well, by accident. You know, I got invited to go down to Brazil to make some records down there. And, you know, in Brazil, I would say it's the closest I feel to being a Beatle. They treat me like Godhead. Because if you remember Guns N' Roses, and still to this day, we would pack stadiums down there, you know, multiple nights. We did Maracanã Stadium in Rio. Two nights sold out, 150,000 a night. We were top 1 through 6 on the charts. You know, like I got there and I remember we were like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6, like on the charts. And just a huge band. To this day, I go down there. So anyway, they just love me down there. So I go where people love me. You know what I mean?
And, why not? Yeah.
Yeah. I always say that to musicians. They go, oh man, I can't get any gig. I go, there's a lot of people in the world. Go out there and find them, you know?
Yeah.
So Brazil, I have this relationship with some people and we ended up doing these records for global television. And then that morphed into a company that was backing music and art and then moved into a startup company. And we started building startups. We started with a thing called Artbit that is still in the works. It's actually taken almost 5 years to build. And these startup things sometimes get complicated with partners. And then regulation because we were doing something on the blockchain with cryptocurrency. It's very difficult.
ArtBit is a type of crypto, right?
ArtBit is a token, yeah.
Yeah.
So out of that, we morphed into biotech. I'm in a biotech company. It's crazy. And I got invited to speak on for the UCLA Global Business Blockchain Council. And I started learning about blockchain and understanding a lot of the solutions that could bring to music and art. And now what you see going on with NFTs is a prime example of peer-to-peer and direct-to-consumer and having a piece of something and feeling like ownership, almost like back to the physical world of records. NFTs is now bringing it into a digital world, but saying, oh, I can own this. I can not hold it per se, but it's mine. And it's not just me streaming and this lackadaisical sort of like I'm going to push a button and go get in an elevator. This is like this direct contact with that particular artist, getting layers of fan interaction, however you want to perceive it, in a tokenized world. And the solutions that can happen in blockchain with publishing, ticketing, all those things, there's a lot of middlemen that can be cut out. And that will happen along the way as you see cryptocurrency becoming more and more of a mainstream and tokenization.
Do you think that's going to happen, though? What I think is going to happen is there's going to be some federal regulations that are going to make it a lot less attractive. And I'm talking crypto in general, not just one in particular.
Well, if you look at the length of how long money has actually been on the planet, it's not that long. Before, we used to trade in gold, silver, you know, tobacco.
Yeah.
When the settlers first came to America, there was no money. There was no cash. Money and cash has only been around for a certain amount of time, right? And that's for these people to put themselves in the middle of how to distribute it. And if you look at the economy in America and what's happened to the banks of the world and all this debt we're in, cryptocurrency sets this precedent on a world level. There's no deciphering who's going to have the hierarchy, right? If it's the yen or the dollar or, you know, the pound or the euro. And as the regulation gets talked about, the further it pushes through and the solutions it helps with, you know, guys like Jamie Dimon, the naysayers, are actually starting to whisper things. I mean, I met the guy at Davos. He hates it, but he hates it because he has a job pushing paper.
Yeah.
And the guys in the record business have the same job. They have a job that we actually don't need them for, because the blockchain and smart contracts could allow streaming and downloading of all your music to pay you in real time. We could actually get streamed. And with that digital information on a node, that currency could be all the players within that node on that particular piece of music. Imagine this. Would get distributed funds automatically. But the problem is companies like Spotify and all these big conglomerates have large buildings and guys on massive salaries. And it's just another record company and political situation that we're in. Fast forward to NFTs, it's another way to say, here I am. I'm not going to throw my shit in the middle of Spotify and expect to be found. I have to be more creative. I've got to create art just like we used to do for album covers. Remember? We'd make the record. Now we got to do the artwork. That would take 6 months sometimes. Just trying to figure out what it looked like. So I'm excited about the NFT space and I'm in it. I'm working on a really big NFT thing called Theos. Theos.fi, check it out. And then I'm working on another NFT project that's NFT funding science. That's called the Global Pandemic Shield. And artist funding science and medicine for people that can't afford it in countries like Brazil, India, Africa, where if you see what's happening in those countries during this pandemic, the poor people are left to themselves. They're just like out there. Well, we haven't, you know, when Zika virus hit Africa, did anybody care? No, because there's no money in it. Pfizer, Merck, these guys, Moderna, they're going to get money from people in Africa? No. So they don't care about tropical diseases like Zika, malaria, dengue. Read up about dengue and see how many people die from dengue a year. You don't hear about it. Why? Because it's a tropical disease. They call it a third world problem. So that's the kind of shit I'm into. And you know what? It's fascinating. For me, it's like in music, I've done so much stuff. It's almost like a really exciting space for me in a creative aspect. If you hear me talk about it, I get really passionate.
Yeah, absolutely.
I get like, oh my God, this is, we could solve a lot of problems. So I, you know, I've gone to Davos twice. I've spoke in front of Richard Branson and Sergey Brin of Google at the Necker Island in Morocco. I get invited to these things, and all my partners are Brazilian, so they speak Portuguese, right?
Yeah.
And they go, Mac, you have to tell them in English, you know. So I'm basically a spokesperson for stormgroup.io. Check it out. STHORM.io. Yeah.
Okay. Let's transition a little bit and talk about your book. Oh, before that, Drummer Beer. Where did that come from?
Brazil.
Okay.
Yeah, it was really funny because I always loved Brazil, right? Like, I remember going to Brazil and going, wow, what is this stuff? Acai. I was eating that stuff in 1990 when I was down there. And now I was like, we need to bring this to America. And I could have done that 20, 30 years ago, but I didn't. And then I saw those sandals down in Brazil called Havaianas. And these are great. You should bring these to America. So I was always into this drink called cachaça, which is a Brazilian tequila in a way. It's made from sugarcane. And everyone drinks it in Brazil. It's like almost kind of like a tequila, and they mix it with lime and sugar. It's like a margarita in a way.
Yeah.
And I was like, man, I really wanted to do this cachaça. And I called my friend Sammy Hagar, who's the rest is history, and what he did with tequila, $100 million deal. He says, yeah, that's great. It's a great brand, but the name, stuff, cachaça. I go, yeah, you're right. So I ran across this guy. I was down there with my blockchain buddies, and this beautiful distillery outside of Sao Paulo called Piracicaba. And I drove out there to the sugarcane mill. And guy says to me, Gustavo, he says, I want to make you a beer. And I said, let's call it O Baterista, which is Portuguese for the drummer. He goes, no, English, the drummer. I go, I'm in. That was it. It's coming, it'll launch in America September 1st at Bristol Farms.
What does it taste like? Can you compare it?
It's an American lager. It's made with Belgian hops. The distillery is Belgian style, but it's an American lager. And then we're going to do two IPAs. And I'm really tight with the guys at Bristol Farms. They have 12 stores here. So we're going to start there. And then I'm going to do a lot of stuff online, like fun, like drum circles and stuff.
Yeah.
And they're creating like a rhythm vibe, like based on rhythm, you know, the rhythm of your life, the drummer, blah, blah, blah. So that was just like a fun. And the guy said, I'm going to do it. And he's doing it. And I'm, you know, behind it. So it's cool.
I can't wait. I can't wait. Let's talk about your book. So you mentioned before it was 4 years in the making. I know a lot of brain cells die in the making of a book. What brought this on?
I don't know. I mean, people would always say to me, I'd tell stories. My wife gets tired of them. She's like, oh, don't tell that one again. And people always say, oh, you got to write a book. You got to write a book. I tried to do it before with a couple other writers, my old friend, Lon Friend, who used to work for Rip Magazine years ago. And the timing was off and I wasn't quite in the space where I am now, which I'm very tan. I'm like, what? It was like a really good thing to just sort of get it out, you know, and just write it. And I met with these two writers from Sweden. There's like a team, Leif Erikson and Martin Svensson. And these guys in Sweden, they speak better English than we do, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And they came to my house in Palm Springs, and we sat there for, you know, we would do 4 or 5 days, and I would just be exhausted. 4 days of just telling stories, right?
Yeah.
And I would just be wiped out. I'm like, you guys, I can only do 4 days. I'm wiped out. Because it was so, like, a lot of stuff. And it took about a year to get that done and then edit. Then the pandemic hit. I was supposed to go on tour with it. So we just pushed it. I'm like, I can't go do Seth Meyers. Can't go to New York. I was going to do this bookstore tour. So I'm like, you know what? Let's hold on. We went back and I ended up doing this vinyl record that goes with it. I don't know if you saw that.
I did, yes.
I did an audio record, but just bits and pieces of the book and certain readings. It's almost like a spoken word thing over music. And I recorded it all up in Josh at my friend's Christopher Thorne, who was from the band Blind Melon. We were up in this cool like studio in the mountains and literally stayed up for like 48 hours and tracked the whole thing in 2 days. And it came out really cool. And the book company is called Rare Bird. And they did some cool books. They did a book for Angelica Houston. And she did a spoken word thing. And I listened to it and I'm like, that's cool. I could do something. And each part of the book that I spoke about had a different musical sensibility. It was like a soundtrack.
Yeah.
And I'd done it before, so I understand how to branch into it. And that's going to be vinyl. So when you buy, you'll get this vinyl record.
Oh, that's cool.
I think there's a lot of pre-orders, so that's good.
Yeah, definitely. What did you learn from doing it?
I learned a lot about myself. You know, I look back and I learned that I've changed a lot. And it was interesting because I actually did 3 versions of an edit. And every time I edited, there was a lot of forgiveness in it, which was great. You know, I'm like, man, I don't need to talk like that. Or I don't need to say it that way. Little words that I take out. I'm like, I don't need to. That sounds bitter. I'm not going to change that. I'm not bitter, but I sound bitter.
Yeah.
Or any kind of resentful sort of thing that I might have worded it a certain way that it just came out like pointing a finger. Or so that was a really great learning process for me to find forgiveness in a lot of the writings. And also forgive myself and things that happened along the way. And, you know, like it's a life story. It's just a life story. It's about a kid coming to Hollywood, trying to make it in rock and roll. Train goes off the tracks. You know, it's almost like a VH1, story. But train gets back on the tracks. Hardest part to write was the end of the book. You know, obviously I'm married and I'm happy. And I had my first baby. And that's not juicy enough for some people. I'm like, well, sorry.
Did you have trouble remembering certain things with accuracy? And the reason why I bring this up is I co-wrote a book, The Autobiography of Ken Scott. Ken was one of the 5 Beatle engineers and recorded Bowie and whatever, right? So he goes way back to the 60s, obviously, with the Beatles. And there was a lot of times when he would go, I just don't remember. And the good thing was I got to talk to a lot of other people and everybody kind of remembers it differently sometimes. There was one thing in particular. So Ken is talking about his early days at Trident and he tells me about how it's all laid out and how they have a machine room upstairs and all the tape machines are up there. And out of nowhere, I get a call from a former roadie of mine. And we come from a small town in Pennsylvania, 5,000 people. And he went on to be a roadie for another band that happened to record at Trident around that same time. And he had a bunch of pictures. So he sends me these pictures. And there's one picture that has Ken with Roy Thomas Baker in the control room.
Yeah.
With a tape machine in between them.
Wow.
So I call up Ken. I said, Ken, so you said there's never a tape machine. He says, no, it never happened. Ken, I have a picture right here. No, that never happened. That can't be right. I talked to all the other people, the maintenance people, everybody else that were there. No, we never had that. No. I said, I got a picture. Look, it's right here.
Wow.
And finally somebody said, oh yeah, I remember. Maybe we did that for about a week.
No, I did really well with it. You know, it's weird for me. When you start one story, it opens up these, remember other things. And people used to say that to me. They're like, Rain Man. I like remember so much shit. Even as much as I drank and partied, I always took it all in. I used to joke. I used to say, this is going to be really good for the book because I can remember room numbers. Wow. There's a story in the book where me and Ian Astbury from The Cult almost burned down this hotel. And to this day, it was 1989. It was room 626. And I would always put things together with why I remember. If I met somebody and their name was Dave, I would connotate that with my dad or, you know, whatever that was. I'd connect the dots.
Yeah, yeah, right.
So I have this memory bank that's pretty insane. And then it opened up a lot of things that I forgot about, but they would open up and I go, bing, and there it was. It's in there. It's in the cavity, right?
You can find out more about Matt at mattsorum.com. That's Matt, M-A-T-T, Sorum, S-O-R-U-M.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or you can find it on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Mixcloud, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Deezer, TuneIn Radio, Radio Public, and Podbean. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.